Hi, welcome to this week's program. As part of my Live Well series, I wanted to address the financial implications of having children, or more specifically, having your first child. While becoming a parent is very exciting and fulfilling, it's also significantly life-changing in many ways. So here, let me focus on the financial aspects of becoming a parent. Well, if you're a two-income couple, one of the first changes you might face is a straight reduction in your wife's income should she go on short-term or extended maternity leave. So the many young, expecting couples are faced with a sudden loss of income of the mother. So make sure, as soon as you find out you're going to become parents, that you use the remaining 7 or 8 months before the baby's birth to set your finances in order and rejig your lifestyle to accommodate a new person in your household and a drop in take-home pay. In instances where the mother is not working, adjust your lifestyle for the added expenses of the newborn, too. And ideally, if you can, plan ahead as soon as you're married or in a relationship where the two of you would want children. Also, if you're employed by a larger company, speak to your employer to see if you're covered by short-term disability insurance that could pay you up to 70% of your gross income for about 6 weeks, typically. Also, check with HR on the maternity benefits and make full use of them on things like your insurance copays that treat a pregnancy like any other medical condition and plan ahead for necessary out-of-pocket expenses. All right, so in addition to loss of income, a baby comes with multiple expenses, such as added healthcare deduction from your salary, out-of-pocket hospital expenses for the mother and child, temporary periods of absence for the father that could also result in reduced pay close to the time of delivery, and of course, money for the baby's clothes, the toys, the crib, the formula, the diapers, and so on and so on. You're sort of hit by a mini tsunami of expenses when a baby is born, so it's best that you be as prepared as possible. Now, a lot of excited parents tend to get carried away and buy expensive cribs, expensive clothes, and so on. You know, driven by a noble thought where they want to give their child the best they can afford. But frankly, the child knows no better. A $1 toy from the dollar store is often as exciting and challenging as a $50 gift from your favorite baby store. My dad used to say the best toy for a child was a jar with some pennies. Put the pennies in the jar, he'd take them out of the jar. And that would satisfy his time for hours, he would say. So really, it isn't the price of the toy that you pay for. It's really whether the toy itself is fascinating the child. Also, a fancy crib made of solid wood can easily be substituted by something that's way less expensive and allow you to focus on the basics and then some. You know, give your child a comfortable mattress and a warm blanket, and you'll be fine. This is also a good time to look for used items. You know, you can get excellent quality children's items that other kids have simply outgrown, and they're going for a song. Similarly, use events such as the baby shower to ask for practical and inexpensive gifts so you can get 2 or 3 really useful things in place of items that the baby's really indifferent to. And in doing so, that helps to reduce your expenses by getting those necessary and basic items. Of course, we all want our kids to look cute and all, so go ahead and buy a few pretty clothes, but stick to thriftier stores if you can. They too have plenty of good options that will not reduce your baby's cute quotient. Instead, invest in things that matter, such as good quality diapers, good quality and healthy baby food and formula, a good car seat. I always say, buy great socks, and what I mean is, it's wise to pay up for something that will last a long time and give you pleasure with its use. Kids outgrow clothes pretty quickly, so I don't think paying up for a whole wardrobe is a great idea. An item or two, sure, but you can save money by paring back on the rest. Now, looking way ahead, as soon as you have a baby, you can also start socking away for the baby's education. There are tax-free contributions to the Coverdell Education Savings Account. There's tuition programs like the 529 plans that let you invest today so the money grows tax-free. As I've repeatedly said, use the power of compounding by starting with small but regular contributions. Invest this money in higher-yielding securities like stocks at first, then gradually shift the allocation to bonds or CDs as your child reaches an age where the funds need to be withdrawn. You'll be amazed at how effective these plans are in reducing future education-related expenses. Maybe suggest these to your parents and grandparents as a way they can help if they're so inclined. And finally, don't ignore your own retirement. And through it all, make sure you don't also ignore the contributions that you have to make for yourself. If circumstances or financial constraints make money tight, reduce your contributions down to $100 or even $50 a month, but keep the continuity and the discipline and actively streamline your lifestyle preferences to your new circumstances, to the point where you still manage to save enough for retirement. See, if your household income drops from $100,000 to $50,000 suddenly, it may seem like there's no way you can save. But I've come across enough individuals who make less than $50,000 a year, have children, yet manage to steadily build their financial nest eggs. It may seem hard at first, but if you have the will to save, you will find a way. And after all, the reason for all of this is to have the most control of your life as possible. And since we only have one chance at this life, having wealth gives you the freedom and the flexibility to have your one best financial life. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. In a crowded business world where everyone is vying for our short attention spans, being very different from your competition is the key, and branding is one of the most important ways for businesses to break out of the crowd. Not only businesses, but also for us as individuals, personal branding is another important tool to help us get what we want from this crowded world. Julie Cotino is founder and CEO of Brand Twist, a brand consultant and creator of Brand School Online. And prior to launching her own business, she was vice president of brands at Richard Branson's Virgin Group. Her new book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Build Breakthrough Brands. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve. Glad to be here.
You mentioned in your book, Twist, you describe a pivotal moment when you were in the airport that changed your perspective and gave you a new vision. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was at Newark Airport and I was traveling as a brand consultant and I was running for my plane and frankly, not really enjoying the whole business travel experience. I find it very bland, very me too. And all of a sudden I was stopped in my tracks by the image of a 747 with McDonald's golden arches on the tail fin. And in that moment, I thought to myself, wow, that's a different kind of airline. You know, I bet that airline has a very service-oriented attitude, maybe bright colors, maybe a menu of options. Maybe I could get on the plane, see it was crowded, and supersize my economy seat to a business class seat or a first class. And I started getting really excited about this airplane. And I realized all of a sudden that it was a mirage. It was actually the reflection of the food court on the window of the neon McDonald's sign, and there happened to be a plane parked there.
What did that mean to you when you saw that? What flashed in your mind that got you moving in their direction?
I just had such a big aha that the way to really break out in any category is to take off your brand blinders, to forget about what your competition is doing. Look at brands that you love that are breaking through, that are doing well in other categories, and use or twist those best practices.
You say brand blinders. So you think most people, most business people and individuals walk around and they just take on too much of a me too attitude? You mentioned dentists in your book.
Yeah, I think in every category, you know, it's not like they're making a mistake. I think it's natural. It's just that you live and breathe your business, you're looking at your competition, you're reading certain trade publications. For a lot of small businesses, you're spending a lot of energy trying to look legitimate. And often that means inadvertently sounding and looking and promising the same things as everybody else.
So if I'm a small business person and I have a limited budget, how do I start thinking about this seemingly creative exercise that I'm going to have to develop? Maybe I have someone helping me with logo and so on. How do I do all of this? How do I get from point A to the point where you want me to be?
Yeah, I think the first thing is you have to just become a student of brand. And I don't mean, you know, textbooks or classes or something complicated. I mean, just start to notice which brands you as a human being, not necessarily as a business person, are noticing. You know, where are you getting great customer service? What are the brands that you are raving about, that you're telling your friends and family that they need to try? And then really look at what are those brands doing specifically, not just in terms of their logo and messaging, but their whole experience. And then thinking about what could you beg, borrow, and steal to incorporate into your own brand.
So what can we learn? I mean, there's a lot of great iconic brands in our world, and these are brands that have been developed over, in some cases, over 100 years or more. I'm thinking of Coca-Cola and the like. Give us a takeaway that we can learn from a Coca-Cola or an Apple or a Virgin.
Yeah, well, Virgin obviously is a brand near and dear to my heart. And I think one of the smartest things that Virgin does is they look at the brand experience as a continuum. So they don't just think about your airline experience as the time that you're on the plane. For Virgin Atlantic, for example, it starts, they pick you up, they drive you in a limousine to the airport, they make it easier to check in. They have a different kind of clubhouse experience. You know, on the plane, they have a different approach to entertainment. They have a bar in the middle of upper class, you know, a real bar where you can sit and have a drink and chat. And then when you land, they'll take you to your destination. So it's all of those little touch points, large and small, that we should be thinking about as business people. What are the moments of magic where I can surprise and delight my customer?
It sounds to me, though, you're talking about the difference between a brand and a business model. I think in my own mind, what you've just described to me is a business model of heightened service, extra service, something special. But is that the brand that a small business person is thinking, or is that a business model?
Well, it's a great question, Steve. In my mind, they're the same thing. Your brand is your business.
Uh-huh.
And the number one mistake I see large and small clients making is they think that their brand is just their logo, their name, their website. You know, one of the things that I encourage my students and clients to think about is from the very beginning, how can I build in branded elements, magic moments to my business model so that if what you see is missing in your category is customer service, you know, don't just add that on in the end with a tagline that says we care, you know, really build it into the way the business is structured. That's brand.
Find the need and fill it is what my daddy used to say. And I think it follows that theme. My guest is Julie Cotino. She is the CEO of Brand Twist and also Brand School Online. She was also the vice president of brands at Richard Branson's Virgin Group. Her book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Breakthrough Brands. Let's talk about personal branding, Julie. You mentioned that you think you should start thinking about your brand really early on in junior high school or something.
Yeah, I do. And I have two teenagers, one who's in college and one's a sophomore in high school. And it's really hard to get into college these days. There's just so many different candidates, you know, vying for the same spots. So I think early on, you have to start to think about your own personal brand narrative. You know, what am I going to write in my essay that helps this university who has a split second to look at each application, understand me, get me, and want to know more about me?
Yeah, I'm thinking about Legally Blonde right now and the video that she sent. That made an impression on me. I don't want to go there. So millennials in particular, you mentioned that the unemployment rate nationwide for millennials is 9% or something around that figure. They've really got to figure out how they're going to get what they want from this world. What are you suggesting to them at their later ages?
Well, one of the great things about millennials is they're digital native. You know, they're really good at social media, Facebook, Twitter, Vine, whatever it is these days. So curate your content. You know, make sure that what you're putting out there is telling the story that you want to be out for potential employers. And I also think editing is really important. You know, a lot of millennials have grown up with so many different talents. You know, their parents are, you know, asking them to get involved in sports and arts and, you know, community service and all these different things. And that's fabulous. It's creating really well-rounded people. But as an employer, it can be a little overwhelming to understand somebody. So, you know, I suggest you pick one thing that you're passionate about. You know, for my daughter, it was music, but she used her community service was around music. She did work in a music therapy institute. She worked as a music TA at our synagogue. You know, her thesis for her senior paper was around the idea of music in literature. So you can make it well-rounded, but if you make it well-rounded and focused at the same time, then people are going to understand your personal brand, your story, a lot easier.
That's very good advice. The book is Twist, How Fresh Perspectives Build Breakthrough Brands. My guest is Julie Cotino. Julie, is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, they can go to brandtwist.com.
Brandtwist.com. And of course, to find out more about Julie, to hear this segment again, don't forget to join us and join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Julie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. My next guest is a Boston-based journalist who chronicles the glorious underbelly of American society, and he has spent a lot of time investigating the great con artists of the 20th century, and he writes about one in his book, My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. And the journalist is with me here today. His name is T.D. Norton. Hi, T.D. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
So I had never heard of George Graham, otherwise known as G.G., but from the way you describe it in your book, he sounds like one of the greatest characters of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, that's fairly interesting that you brought that up, because I had never heard of George Graham Rice either before I had started researching the book for My Adventures with Your Money. And the genesis of how I stumbled upon George Graham Rice was I was actually working on a freelance article about con artistry, a magazine piece, and I had researched an article. I'm a serial Googler, and I had landed on a 1934 article from Time magazine, and basically the gist of the article, when I found it a few years ago, was, whatever became of George Graham Rice, who was the greatest con artist of his era, why aren't the modern con men as charismatic as this guy is? And I had followed the shadow world of confidence hustling peripherally, kind of as a hobby. And I said, wow, how come I've never heard of this guy? And it was like an onion. The more I started delving in and the more layers I uncovered about George Graham Rice, I found out what a fascinating and forgotten character that he actually was in the early part of the 20th century. He was front page news basically from 1900 up until the Great Depression. And the reason a lot of people have never heard of George Graham Rice today is, without a spoiler alert, without giving away the ending of the book, his downfall coincides with the roller coaster ride up during the Roaring Twenties and then the massive crash in the Great Depression. And by the time George Graham Rice went from big time to small time, it was no time. However, in his day, he was the fraudster in terms of scale that we would compare to a modern Bernie Madoff, except the critical difference is George Graham Rice, which was only one of his many aliases, by the way, he operated with the flair and showmanship of P.T. Barnum, the circus promoter.
Yeah, let's get into that. Hang on a second. Let's get into that because there's a lot here. But just to whet my listeners' appetite, this person that you speak of, this George Graham Rice, he pioneered many of today's modern marketing ideas, concepts that are still in use a century later. For example, the celebrity endorsement, using sex as a selling tool, outlandish publicity stunts, telemarketing, customer profiling of all these things. And then he wrote a tell-all book after that. So on the one hand, he did all this to swindle suckers out of their money. But on the other hand, I guess modern advertising is kind of all about that in a legitimate fashion today.
Yeah, George Graham Rice was nothing short of brilliant. And I make the point in my Adventures with Little Money that he could have, had he wanted to apply his intelligence to legitimate business purposes, I think we'd be speaking about him in a totally different light today and not the nefarious shadow world that he occupies in con artistry. But you ticked off a list of some of the things that he pioneered. And to set the scene for your listeners, this goes back 100 years ago when, if you were affluent enough to have a telephone installed in your house, you were thrilled to hear a jangle. You didn't care if it came from what we would know today as a telemarketer calling and trying to sell you something. George Graham Rice pioneered telemarketing. He was one of the first sales persons to instruct his staff to ask people, may I have your telephone number, when they completed a transaction in roughly 1902.
Yeah.
And later on, he was the forerunner of what we would call customer profiling and data mining today, except George was a little more blunt. He called it his sucker list, and he just cultivated a list. By the time he died and they found this list, it had over 200,000 names on it.
Oh my.
And he first started cultivating these names when he was a racetrack horse tipster, and he kept the names as he went out west to dabble in mining stocks, and when he came back to Wall Street to open what were called bucket shops, which were low-rate, cut-rate brokerage houses that never really invested your money. Every time he had a point of contact with these people, your file in his file cabinet grew fatter and fatter, and you didn't realize some of these people were contacted numerous times over decades from many of the different schemes and scams of George Graham Rice. And it might be apocryphal, but it was rumored that he even had subheadings in his sucker list under names like elderly philanthropists and millionaire widows. And he would, in a predatory fashion, he would go after these people.
Yeah.
He wouldn't be satisfied to take you for, if he knew you had $20,000 to give up, he wasn't going to be satisfied if he got $19,000.
Gotcha.
He would go for the full banana.
My guess is T.D. Thornton. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. So let's learn about one of these cons. I was particularly interested in the very first one where he, I'll let you explain it, but it has to do with racing, and I want to get into one thing that I noticed that made him different, but tell us very quickly about the story, his very first biggest con.
George Graham Rice had gotten out of jail on some forgery charges, and he was basically broke, and he had $7.10 to his name. This was in March of 1901. He was standing on a street corner in New York City, and off in the distance, he spied an old racetrack chum. George was looking for, he was on the hustle looking for marks who were ripe to be suckered. He didn't necessarily want to fleece his friend, but his friend came over to him. His friend was a little bit more down in his luck than George Graham Rice was. George bought him a beer. They got to talking. One thing led to another. And his friend said, hey, I have a very legitimate hot racehorse tip that I just received by telegram from a guy in New Orleans who knows his stuff. And this amounted to insider trading in the horse racing world. George knew that this horse, or had inside information that the horse had a good chance to win at odds of 10-1, but he was smart enough to, he didn't want to make $70 off of this transaction, which is what he would have got if he bet the horse straight up, $7 to win at 10-1. He wanted untold riches. He wanted a bigger entry into the world of separating suckers from their money. So what he did with this pit was he took his last $7, he went down to what today is known as the Daily Racing Form, the Bible of American horse racing newspapers. He bought a tiny ad in the back of the paper. He ran it the next day. It said, bet your last dollar on the horse's name was Silver Coin. He will win today. I have inside information. And if you like this tip and the horse wins, I have a new horse racing business, a tout service that's in business. And if you like it, this is a freebie. But after that, it'll cost you $5 a day, which was an exorbitant sum in 1901,
right,
if you want my inside information. Now, this scam only hinged on the horse winning. If the horse didn't win and ran up the track, George's advertisement would have gone into the trash. Nobody would have made any money. Nobody would have followed him. But as luck would have it, the horse won, and he won big, paid a nice price. And the next day, when George went to the storefront walk-up that he had rented on Broadway, he was surprised to see that the line extended out the door and down Broadway. He had hundreds of suckers lining up wanting to give him $5 the next day for his next hot horse tip, yeah, and he was off and running in the tell system.
Yeah, so TD, this is what I find fascinating. I think most of us would have taken that tip, taken our $7, and been happy with earning $70 to get us through, you know, the next couple of months back in 1901 dollars. But he had bigger visions. This guy was very smart from the very beginning, and so he started this company. It was totally bogus. He rented some closet of a space. And he got a second tip, and that tip kind of worked out, too, and he built a little bit business until what? It fell apart?
Well, it eventually fell apart because it came under federal scrutiny, because to back up a little bit, he eventually built up the business to the point where he had so many suckers subscribing to his daily horse racing tips that he was able to give, let's say on a scale of if there were 10,000 customers a day and there was a five-horse race at Belmont Park in New York, he would divide it up, and he would give each of the 2,000 subscribers a different horse. So if you scale it up, every day he was giving out a winner. Some people were getting fraudulent horses that didn't work out, but eventually they landed on a winner, so they stuck with him. Yeah. And his business was big enough that he was not content to just take in walk-in customers. He went about his business by the mail. And, you know, in 1901 and 1902, it was technically not illegal to commit fraud in the United States. However, the way the government got you was they came in the back door instead of marching boldly up the front steps. If you use the federal mail system, the Postal Service, to defraud people, they would get you for mail fraud. And that's eventually how he went to smash on his horse tout racing business.
You know, it's interesting because you mentioned this idea of having, say, 10,000 customers and five horses and giving 2,000 the name of a horse. So 2,000 out of those 10,000 think that you're very smart. And then you take those 2,000 and you divide that by five, and then, you know, 400 of those think you're a genius. And by the time you get down to it, you've got, you know, whatever, 50, 100, 200, 500 people who think that you can't lose and you can charge them more and more money. That used to be a stock broker scam, by the way. Tell half your customers to buy, half your customers to sell. Half them think that you're a genius after you've done that two or three times. And they can be very powerful. We are very limited on time, unfortunately. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. My guest is T.D. Thornton. His first book was Not by a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. And again, you want to read about George Graham Rice. I know I personally love stories about these great con artists. And, you know, I had some dealings with Bernie Madoff, and I was able to save a number of clients from a Bernie Madoff. So I'm very, very much aware of the dangers of these scam artists. And so I like to read about them. Final words, TD?
I think that one thing that your listeners should keep in mind is that con artists are a cyclical phenomenon. The core methods that they will separate you from your money don't change. What does change is technology and the methods by which they go after you. So George Graham Rice, in his day, it was the newfangled telephone and suckering people by telegrams. And today we do it by the internet. The same scams, the I'm a Nigerian prince seeking some help getting money. Can I use your bank account emails that we all get and have hopefully hit the delete key on every day are no different than something that was called the Spanish prisoner scam that was in vogue in George Graham Rice's time.
Well, I guess P.T. Barnum was right. I guess there is a sucker born every minute.
And, you know, the interesting thing is when I researched that quote out for My Adventures with Your Money, the true con artistry of that is P.T. Barnum never actually said that.
Oh, he never did.
it's attributed to him, but he never actually said it.
Very good. My guest, T.D. Thornton, a Boston-based journalist. The book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. T.D., thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hold on to your wallet.
Take care. Bye-bye. To hear more stories and more interviews, don't forget to join our conversation and also to find out more about T.D. Thornton and his book. Join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com.
There is a sucker born every minute. Each time that second hand sweeps through the top like dandelions, up they pop their ears so big, their eyes so wide and low. I feed them bona fide baloney with no truth in it. Why, you can bet I'll find some room to buy my corn, 'cause there's a sure shooting sucker born a minute, and I'm referring to the minute you was born.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And you are once again in the house.
That's right,
happy
in the house.
To hey, see hey. You. No pun intended using the word house here.
Or story.
Okay. Hey, I read an article that was talking about two counties that I was not familiar with in Florida, where the top 5% of the homes, the most expensive homes, have grown by 19% and 14%.
I know.
This year.
That's crazy.
So let's talk about those counties.
Sure.
Let's move there. Where are they? Who are
Sarasota.
They? Sarasota. Sarasota County.
Yes.
Okay.
And Collier.
Okay. So where is Sarasota County?
You know, it's south of Tampa by about 75 miles.
Okay. So it's, what, about a 3.5 hour?
From Broward County.
From Broward County?
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
And then Collier County, which is also known as East Naples.
Naples. About 100 miles west.
Just west. Broward.
Broward, yeah.
Yep. On the other side of the swamp.
On the other, it's where all the alligators go.
Yep.
For vacation, I guess. All right. So this is important because these are now hot markets, especially the top tier. It's a lot of people moving down from the north, realizing that they can get much more for their money.
That's right.
And they can enjoy Florida sunshine and get away from the cold weather and all this. And those two counties. But Broward County's doing quite well as well. I think Broward County saw a 9% year-over-year increase in prices as well.
That's right. It was ranked actually number 19 on the list. Mm-hmm. So that's good.
Okay. I thought that was important. Let's get to my favorite segments, which are your real estate survival guide, where I get to ask a question and you get to answer it. Of course, I want to give credit to Gary Singer here, the writer at Sun Sentinel, who really writes this stuff.
That's right. We're just...
We have to admit.
So discussing
it. Here we go. Here's the question. Can a condo make an owner replace old hurricane shutters? Here's the question. We purchased our condo 15 years ago with hurricane shutters already installed. The new property manager is saying that there is no architectural approval form for the shutters in our file, and we may be compelled to take them down. Since nothing was told to us about the shutters 15 years ago, I believe the shutters were approved by the architectural approval form, but the architectural approval form must have been lost between boards and different management companies. Any advice for us, David?
Well, there's some good news here in this story. The shutters can remain. You know, due to the importance of hurricane preparedness, the law states that while the board can adopt specific guidelines for shutters, it cannot prevent their installation or replacement. So your association cannot make you remove your shutters at this point, as long as you maintain them and they're in working order.
Yeah.
So that's what's key here.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't understand they're going to make them remove them and then do what? They have to replace them again?
Yeah.
And that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, they kind of, you know, they waited too long. You can't wait 15 years and expect, no, it doesn't work that way.
I think the property management has a friend in the business. I think that's what's going on there.
Going around selling shutters.
Exactly. All right, next question. Next question is, the seller's fence is over the line. Here's the question. We bought our home a year ago with a fenced-in yard. Recently, our neighbor demanded that we remove the fence from his property, stating it is 2 feet over his line. I looked at the closing papers and saw that the survey does show our fence is on his property. The fence company, the seller, and our title company are telling us they will not help. We bought the house this way, and it does not feel right for us to have to pay to have the fence moved. do we?
Here's the answer. Yes. Now, what you have to understand is all of this is actually covered in contracts. When it comes to these fences, now, I don't know how large this parcel of property was. 2 feet in my yard would be huge.
Yeah, gotcha.
So, you know,
if you have 5 acres, it's not so much.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it is so common to see on the surveys, fences right on the line.
Yeah.
It goes a half inch in the neighbor's yard, a half inch the other way.
Yeah.
Nobody really cares about that.
But 2 feet.
2 feet, that's kind of a big deal. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, not really knowing if this is 10 acres and it's, but what have you. Yes, unfortunately, it should have been brought to the buyer's attention
at
closing.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, but you know, if they had lived there for a long time and there was no contention, if the other owner had said something, they should have disclosed it.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
If nobody ever said anything and all of a sudden.
And nobody knows, and it's not until you do a survey and then, you know, but I suspect that there's more to this
but
story.
The fact is you're on their property. And you're not allowed to be on their property, so you got to move the fence.
Right.
Okay.
If you ask to. And most people won't even ask because, again, it's usually just a couple inches.
Well, the thing is, if it's 2 feet and that's a lot, it's a lot on their side, too. So they've lost 2 feet.
That's right.
So that's pretty considerable.
And maybe the guy will split it. Depends on how bad the fence is, if it's deteriorated and falling apart or
who knows. Fences aren't too expensive. Okay. Let's move on. When a person goes to rent and gets a rental property and they get it from an established company that is in the business of rentals,
right,
they require certain types of paperwork.
That's right.
The small rental person is more casual about it. The mom and pop, you know, let's say you had a condo, you moved someplace else, and now you're renting out your old condo.
Right.
Some paperwork that people are not getting signed and they need to. What is that?
You know, you really want to have a copy of their social security number, pay stub, and driver's license.
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard to ask for those things. I mean,
well, you know, if they're
going to
want if they want to rent from you, they will. And if you're going to fill out an application, they're going to ask for those things.
Yeah.
So asking for these things are not unusual.
They also mentioned here are paycheck stubs.
Well, first of all, if you have the pay stubs, you'll know if their income supports what their
alleging.
Rent.
Yeah.
Correct.
Right.
And then you know where they work.
Yeah.
And the whole key to wanting all this information is if they skip town, you want to be able to track them down if the judge has to go after them.
And man, oh man, that does happen.
And it does.
Middle of the night stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if I was renting, you know, I guess if I gave a company my social security number, I wouldn't feel too threatened. But if I gave an individual my social security
number. Well, more reason why you need to hire a realtor to help you with your leases. Okay. They will get the information.
Ah, I like that.
I'd feel uncomfortable giving it to mom and pa, too.
And then the driver's license, I mean, that's pretty standard. I don't think it
doesn't
sound too dangerous to me.
No.
Yeah. All right. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's my pleasure to introduce Eric Weiner. Eric was a longtime foreign correspondent for National Public Radio, writes a regular column for BBC Travel, and his work also appears in the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, as well as NPR's Morning Edition. He's written New York Times bestsellers, The Geography of Bliss and Man Seeks God, and he is here to discuss his latest book, The Geography of Genius. This is interesting stuff, so let's meet him. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Happy to be here.
You know, I understand that some of your neighbors have recognized your specialness when you were younger, especially when you dropped a water balloon from 15 floors and broke a neighbor's windshield, and they said, hey, way to go, Einstein.
Yeah, they were they were impressed with my scientific curiosity.
I see.
Yeah. You know, just because you write a book with genius in the title, Steve, does not mean that you are a genius.
So I think you state pretty categorically that you're not a genius, but
right.
You've got some good reason to hope that perhaps someone in your family younger than you may be a genius. What is the definition of genius?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's not. I really think it's not just raw IQ score, being a smarty pants or a know-it-all. It really is creative genius. It's making a conceptual leap. You know, German philosopher Schopenhauer said, and I love this quote, talent hits the target no one else can hit. Genius hits the target no one else can see. That kind of leap. And I should add that once you hit this target no one else can see, other people have to see it then. Otherwise, you're just that nut job in the corner hitting invisible targets. So at some point, your genius needs to be recognized in order to really become genius. It's a social verdict in that sense.
We have these people in history who are notable for hitting a target that no one sees. I mean, Einstein comes to mind for certain.
Right.
And, you know, Mozart as well, and so many others that we can look back. And yet, your philosophy or thinking is that genius is really not a person, it's more of a place. Am I correct on that?
It's both. I don't want to take anything away from a Mozart or a Beethoven or an Einstein, but to look at them in isolation is almost like a shooting star in the sky, that they just come along randomly. And when they do, we look up at the night sky and we go, oh, wow. I wonder when the next one will come along. It doesn't work that way. I mean, a better analogy than the shooting star would be the garden, you know, and the genius is the fruit or vegetable that's grown in the garden. And yeah, you need a good seed, you need that genetics, and you need the water and the hard work, but ultimately you need the right soil, the right place, and the right time to make that genius blossom.
So more nurture than nature.
Yes. You do need the seed, as I said. You need a little bit of nature, but you need a certain kind of nurture, and it's more than just, when you hear the word nurture, you tend to think of mother with her daughter or son or a family and that kind of small-scale nurturing of the unit of the family, and that's important in a way, but I think what's more important is the bigger milieu, you know, that's going on around that person, the place and time they're born into. And I really think that gets short shrift. I think we have largely ignored that, partly because we just are so in love with this myth of the lone genius, you know, against all odds and doing his or her thing without any regard to the world out there. And it doesn't work that way.
Well, you mentioned myths. You know, you write in your book that the myths are that, first of all, a genius is born.
And right.
Genius is made through hard work, and geniuses are kind of grown in the soil somehow. How do you dispel the fact that, you know, genius is not born per se?
Well, I think a good way to look at this actually is with a slightly controversial subject, a question that always comes up. You know, people say, Eric, why are there so few women geniuses in your book? And it's true. And the reason is because there are so few women geniuses historically. Now, why is that? Well, if you subscribe to the genetic theory, you would have to conclude, and I am not concluding, but you would have to conclude that women don't have the genetic wherewithal to become geniuses. And that's why we've seen so few, or that If you believe genius is all about hard work, you'd have to conclude that they don't work hard. Not true. Mm-hmm. So what is it? It's the soil, which has been largely controlled by white men for most of history, and that have not given women, A, the opportunity to pursue genius pursuits, and B, even if they manage to, against the odds, don't give them the recognition. I think that's sort of the best evidence that it's not genetic.
Well, the book is The Geography of Genius, with the emphasis here on the word geography, so it's place that matters. And you say, we rarely see one genius here, one genius there, but instead we see genius clusters. And I think this talks to the idea that it's a lot about the cultural environment that one finds themselves in. And in history, women really didn't get a chance to participate as well in the cultural environment as much as men did. Let's look at some of these places you talked about. You know, you've traveled all over the world to Greece, Italy, Scotland, China, Silicon Valley to investigate how genius takes root. Let's go back in time. You mentioned Florence as a good example.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, you know, when you think of, well, the Renaissance man, obviously you think of Leonardo da Vinci, original Renaissance man, at least in the Western mind. And, you know, he also came out of a system, a creative ecology, I think is actually the best term, one that I like quite a lot. And that was a creative ecology that was really bolstered through money. And I subtitled that chapter, Genius is Expensive. Mm-hmm. And I realize that's a little bit provocative because we don't tend to think of geniuses having anything to do with money, right? They don't need money. They don't work for money. But that's not true. You know, Florence benefited mightily from the generous and very smart patronage of one family in particular, the Medici, who didn't just throw their money around haphazardly. They got art, they understood art, and they had a really keen eye for talent, for spotting invisible talent, if you will, or talent not yet visible, I'd put it that way. And they, more than, frankly, Leonardo or Michelangelo, help explain the greatness that was Florence.
Mm-hmm. You also speak about Athens. Before the golden age of Athens, you said nobody would have bet on them. They were not particularly special. They were weaker than Sparta, but they had certain characteristics which showed up later on. What were those characteristics in Athens?
Well, they drank a lot. That's part of it. No, seriously.
Yeah. Okay.
Recent research shows, Steve, that a little bit of alcohol will make you more creative. Although a lot of alcohol will make you fall down.
Yeah.
And they drank it a certain way. You know, they cut their wine. They watered it down 5 parts water to 2 parts wine, mm-hmm. perhaps knowing that it's more conducive to creative thinking. And they did this drinking in very social settings. Mm-hmm. And this is a common thread. They called it a symposium, literally drinking together in ancient Greek. And there's almost always in these places a venue for people to voice ideas freely, unbridled way. So they had that. And they did a lot of walking, which is very conducive to creative thinking. In fact, they did their philosophizing while walking. But I really, if I were to point to one thing that explains Athenian greatness, I would say it's their port of Piraeus, which they used to sail the entire region and to mooch. The Athenians were great moochers. This is one of the dirty little secrets of the place, is not all that much was invented there, not as much as we think. A lot was perfected there, though. And Plato said that what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. Now, the foreigners might have considered it stealing, but still, that is important. And they had that one trait that psychologists identify as the single most important trait for a creative person, or I think a creative place, and that is openness to experience, openness to the other. And they had what we would characterize in today's terms as an fairly open or liberal immigration policy.
You mentioned taking others' ideas and improving upon them. You also speak about Edinburgh, Scotland, which was really a very out-of-the-way place. It was dirty, it was poor, but they were able to take other ideas and really improve upon them, a better plow, a better steam engine. What was it about Edinburgh, Scotland that brought them into this culture of genius?
Well, first of all, like many of these places, it was not an easy place. It wasn't paradise. It was, as you say, small, kind of dirty and smelly, to be honest, even by the standards of the day, and isolated, perched up on the edge of the world. They just lost their independence to England. So you look at it again, you think they don't have a lot going for them, but they had something to push against. And that's important. And I really do think that creativity is always a response to a challenge. We don't always rise to that challenge, but some places and some people do, and the Scots did. And they really had, and I think still have, a very practical strain of genius that they really believe in, as you say, improvability, whether it's a plow or a steam engine or ideas. And they sort of married the worlds of ideas and practical innovation. And it really came to the forefront in medicine. It was the place for medical research for a while, actually. And some of the founding fathers of this country studied at the medical school in Edinburgh and then returned and signed the Declaration of Independence, for instance, a man named Benjamin Rush. So it was a place where ideas were only of interest if they were practical.
I want to mention that to find out more about Eric Weiner and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. My guest is Eric Weiner, and his book is The Geography of Genius. You mentioned the role of growing up in difficulties. Many of these geniuses you mentioned grew up dyslexic, grew up without a father, or let's say they had some challenge in their lives. And it's a kind of the opposite of perhaps today's society where, you know, employers, for instance, are trying to spur creativity through, you know, giving a lot of perks in their business and so on. You mentioned that, you know, Athens was burnt to the ground before they rebuilt into their golden age. What were some of the other places that kind of went into chaos first before coming out?
Chaos and trauma, really. Florence is a good example. You know, just a couple of generations before the blossoming of the Renaissance around 1400, you know, the city was decimated by the Black Death, the bubonic plague. A third of the population was wiped out. It was horrible, no doubt about it. But, you know, it also shook things up, shook up the social order and created more fluidity, which is really essential for a creative place, fluidity. And that's almost always the case. There's a stirring of the pot. Something is going on. And I saw that time and again in the places I visited.
Chaos seems to be a necessary ingredient.
Yeah, and not anarchy. They're not exactly the same. But a certain stirring of the pot, a certain fluidity to life. You know, there was a neuroscientist actually named Walter Freeman, who studied the brains of rabbits and would hook them up to EEG machines and then introduce these rabbits to odors, some they were familiar with, others they were not familiar with. And he noticed that whenever the rabbits were introduced to an unfamiliar odor, their brains would enter a chaotic state, what Freeman called an I don't know state. And I think that's crucially important. You really need to enter that state of, you can call it chaos or ignorance or I don't know, but something that breaks the previous pattern. And there's a kind of intermediate period where the old pattern is being dissolved, but a new pattern is not yet formed. And call that chaos. That's what it is. And that's essential.
How does that theory explain the burgeoning of Silicon Valley in the United States? We see that as a cluster of genius right now.
Yeah. That's a good question. I've been thinking about this. There was no Black Death, or, you know, the Persians did not burn Silicon Valley to the ground.
And that's a good thing.
But there was the sinking of the Titanic in 1912, which in a strange way, I think, helped lead to the, at least the seeds of Silicon Valley being planted too. Within a year after the sinking of the Titanic, Congress required all ships to carry ship-to-shore radios. Radios were a new technology at the day. And one of the places where there was a huge interest in this new technology was Palo Alto, California, in what we now call Silicon Valley. And that requirement helped the industry a lot, and it helped a few small firms, one called the Federal Telegraph Company in Palo Alto, grow. And it really instilled this sense of tinkering. Amateur radio took off in what's now Silicon Valley. And that idea of the amateur having as much of a right as anyone to play with these new toys, that lasts to this day. So it wasn't a catastrophe on the scale of the plague, but it was the sinking of the Titanic. And it was simply, to be honest, the fact that they were so far away from the East Coast establishment, from the money and the elites and the power, that they were freed up to think freely.
Last question. Do you think more education creates more geniuses?
No, I don't. In fact, statistically, if you have a PhD, you're less likely to become a genius than if you do have one. Mm-hmm. And at first, we might find that surprising because, again, one definition of genius is just someone really smart with a lot of degrees. But if you think about it for a second, it makes sense that the PhD, particularly in today's university system, is for the most part, not always, but for the most part, really required to learn more and more about less and less to specialize. And the creative genius, by definition, is making surprising and useful connections between different fields mm-hmm. or different domains. And I think the sort of specialization you see at not all universities, but many universities, actually discourages that kind of interdisciplinary thinking that's essential for creativity.
Maybe it has also something to do with Dereschowitz's book, The Excellent Sheep, which perhaps we can discuss at another time. My guest, Eric Weiner, the author of The Geography of Genius. And to find out more about Eric and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show was obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.